everyone, and welcome back to the Van Maren Show on LifeSiteNews.com. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we're on a bit of a roll here on the Van Maren Show because we've had just a lineup of fantastic authors of really incredible new books. And the author we're going to be talking today is Dr. Donald Critchlow, who wrote a fascinating, although somewhat disturbing book called Revolutionary Monsters. Now, Donald Critchlow is the Katzen Family Professor at Arizona State University. He's author of several books, including In Defense of Populism, Protest in American Democracy, which was released last year, Republican Character from Nixon to Reagan, The Conservative Ascendancy, How the Republican Right Rose to Power in Modern America, and my favorite, a book that I already have downstairs on my shelf, Phyllis Schlafly and the Grassroots and Grassroots Conservatism, A Woman's Crusade, which is one of the essential books on this subject. He leads the program in political history and leadership at Arizona State University, a certificate program that provides students with a robust civic education. And this book, Revolutionary Monsters, Five Men Who Turned Liberation into Tyranny, is another step in giving people a robust civics education, because he really explains what the difference between the revolutionary mind and, say, a mind focused on reforming is. And he talks about Fidel Castro of Cuba, Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, Mao Zedong of China, Lenin of Russia, and Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. And so really looking forward to this conversation, and I hope you find it as enlightening as I did. So my first question about your book, Revolutionary Monsters, Five Men Who Turned Liberation into Tyranny, is what made you tackle this subject? Because I was actually familiar with your work because I bought your book on Phyllis Schlafly a couple of years ago. It's a really phenomenal book. But looking at the books that you've written in the past, Revolutionary Monsters is definitely a different subject matter than what you're usually writing on.
Well, Jonathan, I was inspired to write the book because I saw polls which said that 52% of young Americans approve of socialism. And then I read another poll that said that 20% of our young people want to abolish private property and have it state-owned. So I thought they needed a wake-up call and a greater understanding of history.
How did you make your selections? Right, you've got Lenin, Mao, Castro, Mugabe, and Khomeini, and that's that it kind of spans a whole bunch of different ideological backgrounds. What made you pick the ones that you did?
Well, I wanted to pick revolutionary monsters from five continents. So I chose Lenin, Mao, Castro, Mugabe in Africa, and Khomeini in Zimbabwe. And what they all shared in common was coming to power with the promise of liberation and then taking power and creating terrorist states, gulags, genocide, and massive oppression.
What do you think is most important for young people to understand about these different regimes? And it's interesting because of the regimes that you lay out, like a couple of these regimes are still suffering under revolutionary leadership, essentially, even decades on. But you notice, I went to a very secular and very left-wing university, and you saw the typical Che Guevara posters hanging up, all over the place. There's people who wore the T-shirts and stuff like that. What do you really want to break through to young people about these revolutionary monsters?
Well, I think many young people are being beguiled now by calls for romantic social justice in which we could create a perfect world and complete social equality. And what we see in these regimes through revolutionary monsters is that the promise ends up with great tragedy. So our 20th century history has been one of war and vile revolutions for the most part.
Now, what are the obvious lessons that we can take away from it? Because you have the Russian Revolution, of course, which finally collapsed in 1991. Mao Zedong's China in a different form is now, of course, one of the major competitors for superpower status on the world stage. What do you think is particularly essential that people understand, the commonalities between all of these very different revolutionaries?
Well, for one thing, I want them just to understand history. Students are being taught a myopic history done through identity, and that distorts the history. So the other day in class, we were talking about the difference between political revolutions and social revolutions, and one of the students told me that he had never heard that Poland had been a communist country, and he'd never heard of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Now, that means that he had been taught history, but not really meaningful history. I mean, I was shocked. So I think we need to, our young people need to have a greater understanding of major events that have happened, and just not view and be taught history through identity theory, which is now occurring in most universities and also occurring in now K through 12 education. So one of the lessons that I want everyone to gather from, garner from Revolutionary Monsters, is that bad ideas begin to seep into the society through young people and the intelligentsia artist, and it makes its way into the society. And when there's social discontent, Revolutionary Monsters, narcissists, take those legitimate concerns with justice and transform them into revolutions that end up in tyranny.
Now, going through your book, one of the things that's really striking about it is just how obviously evil these monsters were. Especially the details about the sheer scale of the killing that Mao Zedong engaged in. And it's kind of staggering when you read through this stuff to realize the extent to which a lot of these men were supported by the elites, right? You know, you might remember the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave a fawning eulogy when Fidel Castro passed away just a couple of years ago. And like I was in Beijing a few years ago, and what really hit me was when I found out that I didn't know this at the time, but when I got there, I realized Mao Zedong is on display in like a glass coffin in Tiananmen Square. And so I went out of curiosity to see this. And there was people bowing, you know, before the embalmed and stuffed corpse of this mass murderer who killed so many people they had to invent a different word, you know, for how many people he destroyed. And I was talking to our tour guide and just saying, like, so, like, how do you square what Mao Zedong did to, you know, tens of millions of people with the fact that you also think he's a great leader? And, like, but she did. Like, it wasn't just her glancing over her shoulder and then defending Mao Zedong. She really thought he was a great leader. And then concurrent to that, I was in Moscow a couple of years ago, and if you go to the graves in Red Square where they've got Lenin sort of embalmed on display as well, the only grave that had any flowers on it was the grave of Joseph Stalin, right? Who I think his kill count was something like 22 million. How do you explain how these people were monsters but also worshipped and revered by so many people?
One of the things that occurred in all of these regimes, which I discuss in Revolutionary Monsters, is the development of a cult of personality in which these men are portrayed as commoners, peasants, representing the people. And also it should be pointed out, as I do in Revolutionary Monsters, that the Western press often goes along with this kind of depiction. Mao was depicted in Red Star Over China, as I discuss in Revolutionary Monsters, as kind of a simple peasant. And kind of intellectual. It should be pointed out, too, that all five of these tyrants, monsters, had university education. So education in itself is an answer to preventing human tragedy.
And you place a lot of blame in your book on the established, the ruling elite, which you just referred to again. Why would you say it's the established ruling elite with these bad ideas that are generally responsible for the revolutions that produce such horrific results?
As I said earlier, there's two major themes, patterns that we see in these revolutionary monsters. One is that bad ideas begin to seep into society through the young and intellectuals and artists and authors. But the other is that when you have upheaval, they confront ruling elites that have become greedy and just concerned with their own power and have lost any confidence in their foundational principles. So they're already weak to begin with. And I might add that we're seeing the same thing in our society today. Bad ideas are beginning to seep in. I had a two students after class last semester come up and tell me that they were libertarian communist. And yes, libertarian communist. If that's not a bad idea. The other theme that I pick up is when elites lose confidence in their own system. And what we're seeing today is our elites in the corporate, media, entertainment, university, educational world are now not only have lost confidence in our foundational principles, the Constitution, rule of law, they're now denouncing these foundational principles as systemic racism, dismissing the Constitution as a white privileged document written just to preserve slavery. So it's not that they've lost confidence in these foundational principles. They're actually rejecting them. And it's and they become all about power and greed and making money without much respect for past history or the future of our very unique and exceptional country.
When you look at, especially Mao Zedong, so many of the things that happened in that in the Cultural Revolution remind me of what we see happening now in terms of, you know, the destruction of history, the statue smashing. I believe it was Peggy Noonan who wrote a really interesting column some time ago comparing these like really maudlin public apologies you get from celebrities and other public figures when they've sort of violated one of the new woke principles to the struggle sessions that got carried out in communist China. Do you see any parallels between what we saw going on under Mao's regime and what's happening here, but like on a cultural level?
Yes, Jonathan, I have to tell you that when I was writing that chapter and researching it, the Cultural Revolution, I was at a university and we were getting inundated with identity theory and the importance of diversity, inclusion, and equity. And so every unit in my university, from the upper administration down to the smallest academic unit, now has anti-racism committees. So, you know, I felt like I was experiencing the same thing you were, Jonathan, while you were watching statues being torn down. I felt that I was in struggle sessions.
Why do so few people actually see the parallels? Like, one of the things that really strikes me about the people's seeming inability to actually place themselves in a different context is, in particular, some of the statues that are being torn down, and in Canada, they've torn down Queen Elizabeth, Queen Victoria, a whole number of pretty inoffensive figures, in addition to, you know, the typical and now traditional villains. But I've often thought I wonder if anybody doing this tearing down, any of these young people who seem so angry about something that they weren't even around for, I wonder if they ever stop to wonder what their ancestors might think of them. Like, it always seems to me that the critiques flow in one direction and that, you know, they think, or they're ashamed of whoever it is that they're tearing down that day, but they never stop to wonder, you know, what previous generations for, you know, 1,000 years might think of this insane generation of people who can't even identify properly what a male or a female is.
You make a good point there, but I think what was expressed in tearing down the statues and what we see with critical race theory and identity history being taught and anti-racist committees being formed at universities with administrative approval is really kind of a mass hysteria. And that's what the Cultural Revolution was. As I describe in Revolutionary Monsters, which on the chapter of Mao, it begins with young students. And at one point, students at the elite Beijing University are looking at a magazine in which they have a wheat field, a cover of a magazine, in which they read within the wheat anti-Mao sayings. I mean, it was absurd. And then they saw that and they go and attack the magazine editor. They began to attack their teachers. It wasn't logical. It wasn't intellectual. It was mass hysteria. And that's why I think we see in mob actions is a kind of mass hysteria. And there's a propensity of people to go along with the mass or collective and with the leaguers. So one has to wonder, as I was writing the book, how people really came to worship Lenin, Stalin, Mao, Castro, Mugabe, and Khomeini. It's a sad tale of the human disposition, and we see it throughout history, and in the Revolutionary Monsters, it becomes poignant and tragic.
When I was in Beijing a few years ago, there's an enormous, their national museum is in the capital, of course. And I spent almost a day going through it. It's one of the most enormous museums I've ever been in. And one of the things that struck me is in a lot of their halls, they have these like 20-foot high paintings of various glorious episodes on China's road to communism, you know, the struggle of the proletariat, you know, the triumph of the peasants and all these things. And unlike most propaganda, like these paintings really were powerful. A lot of them were gorgeously done. And, you know, Jordan Peterson has a really strange fascination with this sort of propaganda, too. And his house in Toronto was packed with very similar paintings, although most of his are Russian. And what I remember commenting to my wife when I was going through this museum, like this is a culture that, despite how evil their ideology is, it believes in itself. And as you've already mentioned, our elites don't seem to believe in Western civilization anymore. They don't seem to believe in our founding stories. In fact, they're rewriting our founding stories with everything from the 1619 Project to the things that you were just pointing out. You know, and it's not that we don't have saints and sinners, they're just swapping places, right? You know, Lincoln must be torn down, and people like Harvey Milk are the new heroes who get the glowing biopics. So what comes after the elites lose faith in their own founding principles? Like, what happens when the Constitution is just a piece of paper, not an animating document?
The role of revolutionaries, and they understand that you need to erase history, and that begins with tearing down statues and then editing history so anyone who is opposed to the revolution or is seen as enemy of the state is erased. So that's what, and they begin with the year zero. So the year zero allows them to create a new history. As I point out in Revolutionary Monsters, all of these revolutionary tyrants sought to create the perfect man, whether it was going to be the new socialist man or the new religious man in the Shiite ideology. Leon Trotsky went so far as to say that under socialism, the very physical nature of man, characteristics of men would be changed. They would speak better, be able to sing, walk more erect and grow taller. So there's kind of a romanticism, a nightmarish type dream they have that you could create a whole new society by erasing the past and beginning anew. And so one of the things they have to do is to tear down statues, eliminate the past, so they could rewrite history in their own way.
Now, when you look at the United States, it's too glib to say it couldn't happen here, because of course it certainly could, and you prove that by covering revolutionary monsters from all these different continents, and it's in a wildly different context. But what do you think a second American Revolution would look like, and do you think it's possible?
Well, I don't. I think what we're experiencing right now, Jonathan, is a quiet revolution. We're step by step, the radical left has taken over our major institutions, and they're pushing very quickly toward a socialist state. The Republicans have attacked the reconciliation bill for its highest spending. But within that bill is a radical expansion of the entitlement state. So the Democrats will settle for, you know, $1 trillion or whatever to get the entitlement programs in place. And then once they're in place, it will be very hard to eliminate them, and then they could pour money in. So I think right now we're experiencing a quiet revolution that's becoming increasingly authoritarian. And the political revolution is going to take place when Americans react as they already are against critical race theory in their schools and in fighting and boycotting corporations that seem so woke and in other ways. So the battle isn't over. The political fight isn't over. I think we're experiencing not a violent political revolution, but one that's proceeding from the elite and the radical progressives.
So the difficulty with it being begun with the elite and passed on is that does seem very effective. You pointed out earlier, right, that it sort of trickles down, and There's a great book by Dr. Daryl Paul on how the elites led America to same-sex marriage is the title. Because he talks about how a very short amount of time ago, the majority of people still believed in sort of traditional biblical sexual ethics. And within a decade, it sort of flipped and we have the inverse now. And so you do have like the normal common people who have gotten on board with these ideologies, despite the fact that these ideologies were propagated from the top down. And then as you pointed out, they've taken over most of the institutions. So I know tons of stories of parents who, you know, send their kids off to school and realize they pay tens of thousands of dollars just for their children to be turned against them and their values. And they're accused of having white privilege and all of these things. And then, of course, you know, you referenced the battle in the public school system. The cynic in me says the public education system can't be saved at this point. It's been so thoroughly taken over and infiltrated. What can a normal person do to push back against the sorts of things that you're describing and the sorts of history as prophecy that you lay out in the book?
Well, I think many people have been persuaded by the radical progressive agenda through a genuine sentiment for social justice and a belief that everybody should be treated equally. But the radical progressives have taken this a step further and are now using government power to crush any kind of dissent. The idea that we're going to unleash the FBI through the DOJ to investigate parents at school boards as potential domestic terrorists should disturb all of us. But we have a media that's tightly controlled. We have many people get their news from the internet, Yahoo, and so they're not very well informed. So we need alternative platforms such as yours, alternative educational institutions, whether it's through school choice or private schools or homeschooling, and we need to begin to create alternatives to what we're witnessing today in America.
I was interested to ask you as well, because you're a conservative faculty member at a state university, and you kind of have a front row seat to watching the next generation sort of pass through, you know, your halls and then head off into the world. What are your students like? Are they woke? Are the data points that you cite reflected in the young people that we meet? Because, you know, some of these data points, what was one of the data points here? That 20% of young people believe all private property should be abolished and owned by the state. Like, I think one of the reasons people don't get as scared as they should be, because that seems so nuts, it's almost hard to believe. But what are the young people coming through your classrooms like?
Well, I think we've seen a gradual drift to the left. But it also should be said that I have many conservative students. I don't propagandize in my classes. Just teaching accurate, meaningful history kind of labels me a conservative, because I'm not just stressing racial, gender, and sexual authority. But we also, what we're seeing, I think, in universities across the country, and I talk to professors at the so-called elite Ivy League schools, is that there's a general and very dangerous decline in students' ability to read. Their vocabularies aren't very good. They have a hard time making written and oral arguments. And I think we're seeing now the consequences of a really bad K through 12 education. But even at private schools, we see that the students aren't as good as they were in the past. And I say that having read many surveys, international surveys comparing our students with European and Japanese students. We're performing poorly, our students in literacy, analytical ability, and mathematics. We're at the bottom in all of these surveys. And even worse, if you take our top students that have performed well on SAT, they're about in the middle, about eighth grade level, most European students. So as a result of this bad education, they're coming in not knowing much, not being able to really analyze much, not having the basically neurons, brain capacity to read. There have been many neurological studies on young kids when they look at videos and TV and movies, although students don't even have the concentration to watch a movie. I kid you not. And there was a recent study that shows that young people can't listen to an entire album. That takes too much concentration. But many studies that show that when you read, your brain comes alive. When you're playing videos, only one part of the brain is developing. So I think, in fact, they don't have the capacity, the hard wiring to read. So with that kind of development, it becomes very easy to pour bad ideas into their brains. You know, I think that's what we're seeing with some of these protests. Now, I don't want to be pessimistic. I have many students that are conservative. I'm faculty advisor to the College Republicans. They're getting huge turnouts at their meetings. And I speak to Republican clubs throughout the Phoenix area, and their luncheons and meetings are packed. They've doubled. So I do think there's hope on the horizon, but it's going to be a long struggle. The radical left had its long march through institutions that began decades ago, and it's not going to take just one election or two elections or any one man to take back our institutions. It's going to take a long march on our part.
A lot of that data you just referred to about, you know, the brain development of young people kind of gets to the heart of a very difficult issue, which is the fact that what we have now is not a lack of information. It's not that people don't have access to books like yours and the research that you used to put the book together. It's that there's so much information that people can scroll TikTok for hours, and they're so distracted by all of these things. And so there's so much information out there that it's literally more than the human mind can actually handle, process, and actually analyze. So, like, how do we go about educating people better when everybody's just hooked on screens from, you know, movies, TV, games, porn, you name it? Because that's an actually systemic problem, and we've all sort of volunteered to do it, but most adults struggle with how much, you know, they're on their smartphone or on Twitter or what have you. And kids who don't even have developed brains yet are starting off with screens at an incredibly young age. And that seems to be a problem that's really difficult to fix, but does need to be addressed.
Yeah, I think this is a long-term problem. But again, I want to share some optimism to those listening to you. Out of my own pocket, I bought some copies of Revolutionary Monsters and offered them free to my students. In a course I teach on modern American political conservatism. And half the class wanted a copy of it. And I've noticed that they've been posting on Amazon.com reviews of it. So I think there is optimism. We have a long fight on our hands, but we haven't lost yet. I do think that many of us, we were talking about what was going on. Kind of laughed at some of the antics of the left, and we kind of dismissed them, thinking nobody was going to accept these kinds of portrayals of and antics. But, you know, suddenly in the last year, we've woken up to a takeover. So that's the first step in I think, a backlash that's coming.
How do we also respond to the rewriting of history over the last couple of years, not just with the 1619 Project, but I'm thinking of things that are even more powerful. So I love your book on Phyllis Schlafly and grassroots conservatism. And as you know, last year, a series called Mrs. America came out with the almost express intention of just destroying her reputation, you know, falsely representing her as somebody who played footsie with racists, who didn't sincerely care about abortion at all, who had a pretty terrible marriage, and really was sort of a bitter woman using a whole bunch of different issues simply to get a leg up in a man's world. And just the film bore no resemblance to the two major books that I've gone back to on this, which is yours, and then The Sweetheart of the Silent Majority by Carol Felsenthal. So how do we compete with these new narratives that are being put out? Like, I almost felt sick when that miniseries got released, because the vast majority of people are now going to get their information about Phyllis Schlafly from this garbage rather than from books like the one that you've written.
Yeah, the Business America was really a foul depiction of Phyllis Schlafly. She actually had a very good marriage. Her husband, Fred, admired her And there were depicting scenes in that biopic that were just so outrageous that it was hard not to get. One of the interesting things that happened with Mrs. America, I was asked by many newspapers throughout the country to respond. So I was quoting, talking about the inaccuracies of the movie. And interestingly, the book sales of Phyllis Schlafly and grassroots conservatism went up. So in a kind of a strange way, a dialectical way, if you will, there was a greater interest in Phyllis Schlafly. Her children were on the news a lot, talking about their loving relationship and their great home and what a great mother Phyllis was and how she inspired many conservatives. So there was a reaction. And let's face it, Jonathan, prior to that, many people didn't know Phyllis Schlafly. I mean, she was somewhat forgotten figure. After that series, many people became interested in Phyllis Schlafly. And even the series had to admit that this was one woman who stepped forward and basically on her own, gathering a support around her, was able to stop a social movement, equal rights amendment, that was fast proceeding. So actually, I think the documentary or this fictional account of Phyllis Schlafly, Mrs. America, had opposite response in showing here's a woman, here's a citizen, here's a woman from a small with a large family in the Midwest who stepped forward, acted on her own, and had a major political effect and a positive one.
That segues pretty perfectly into one of the final questions I wanted to ask you, which is, as I believe you're the only one to publish a major academic book on Schlafly, what would you say her story and what she pulled off, as you just described it, sort of one woman crusade? What sort of lessons can we learn now facing this revolutionary moment and facing all the things that you've been describing? Is there something in her story? Are there details from her crusades that could help equip us now to fight our own battles effectively?
I think there are three lessons that could come out of Phyllis Schlafly's story. First, is to act courageously and hold true to your beliefs. She showed that one woman acting on their own can in fact affect history. And we all pick up that challenge and learn that lesson in a minor way that we are affecting history and those people around us. Secondly, she appealed to common sense and of American women and average Americans. And I do think common sense, aside from all the propaganda people get, still prevails. And thirdly, I think we should understand that social movements can be, from the right, can be powerful. The fact is that we see this in the abortion issue. We're in fact winning that issue. Young people, aside from wherever they stand politically, tend to be overwhelmingly pro-life because they now see through technology that life begins early. So the pro-life movement was, as I described in Defense of Populism, actually was a quite successful movement. So we shouldn't be demoralized by what we're seeing. We should step forward and act as heroes every day in our own small way.
Final question then is, where can people go to buy Revolutionary Monsters and support your other work? I particularly also want to encourage listeners, in addition to Revolutionary Monsters, to purchase your book on Phyllis Schlafly, which is really, really phenomenal.
Well, thank you very, very much. There's a lot of work that went into both books. You can go online, Google in Revolutionary Monsters, and it's for sale on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, many bookstores, and you could go to Regnery Press publishers to publish the book and order it there. But I'm not interested in sales. I want to make this clear. I'm interested in having people read the book. I would like grandparents and parents to give this book to their children and grandchildren. It was written with them in mind. It's short. It's not 300 pages, as it says on Amazon. It's only 200 pages. And I wrote it in a way that was gripping, with short chapters, in order to engage the reader. So I encourage people to give their book to their children, and also I might give it to their woke neighbor, that maybe they'll form a neighborhood patrol.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it with us.
Okay. Thank you, Jonathan. Have a good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was my conversation with Dr. Donald Critchlow on his new book from Regnery Press, Revolutionary Monsters. Thank you so much for joining us this week. If you want to check out past episodes and other conversations with authors, please do head over to lifesitenews.com, click on the podcast tab, and you can find our show there. Thanks once again for joining us this week, and we do hope you'll join us again next week.